And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. Our main guest tonight, Dr. Carmen Bolter, is a professor at the University of Calgary, teaching in the Graduate Division of Educational Research. Carmen has been to 51 different countries to search for clues of lost matriarchal cultures from a golden age. Now, her quest has brought her to Egypt 23 times, where she has done extensive academic research and field work in the pyramid fields around the Great Pyramid. She has recently completed a groundbreaking documentary series called The Pyramid Code. We're going to be talking with her about her discoveries tonight. Here she is, Carmen Bolter. Carmen, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks, George.
Good. It's good to have you on the program. 23 times in Egypt.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, my father was born there. He was born in Cairo.
That's right,
He's not been back since. Tell me, why 23 trips, Carmen?
Well, I've just had so much research to do, and one thing led to another. One research discovery brought on more field work, and I really had a lot of exploring to do. So,
this has been a lifelong quest for you, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
Did you feel a calling when you were smaller?
Oh, absolutely. I started having past life recall when I was 6 years old, and I saw the headdresses and the necklaces on my cousin, actually, and I kind of brushed it away, and then it came back again, and I realized it probably wasn't a good idea to tell anyone. And then when I was 11 years old, I started looking through my father's books, and I found one on Edgar Cayce and another one that had pictures of the inside of the Great Pyramid and around the Sphinx. And I just had this impulse inside me, like, how close can you get to it? And I decided I wanted to go right away, or as soon as I could. And so I asked my mother where Egypt was, and she said, well, look it up in the Atlas. And I looked it up, and I said, how do you get there? And she said, well, call the airlines. So I was making 25 cents an hour, and I found out the tickets were $1,400. And so I started calculating, and I was determined to get there the whole time. And I ended up going for the first time when I was 22. And a lot of things happened there that planted the seeds that just kept me going back.
Now you must have frequent flyer miles. You've got to, huh? That's a lot of, you know what's so remarkable, Carmen, is these events that affect us when we're children, because I went through some similar things, stay with us as we're adults. They form our careers and our paths, don't they?
Absolutely.
Truly amazing. Truly. Now, when you went to Egypt, whether it was the one time or the 23rd time, did you have help and assistance, or did you just go off on your own?
Oh, I was taken under the wing of a few different families. The first time I went, I was on a 14-month trip around the world, and I actually ended up meeting some people who invited me to come and stay with their family. And one of the young gentlemen, one of the sons, ended up taking me to the Great Pyramid, and he showed me how you can stay in there all afternoon, because in those days, you used to go in on the hour every hour, and tourists would stay in there for 10 minutes. And he said, if you just stay back, we can stay in here, and the next group that comes up, we'll hear them, we'll join in, look around. And we ended up staying in the Great Pyramid for 3.5 hours. And I took quite a few pictures, and there were apparitions and anomalies in the pictures. So I took my camera to a camera store and asked what was wrong with it, and they said, nothing. So
nothing.
And so all of a sudden I realized that my camera was picking up on energy fields inside there. And in subsequent trips, I ended up meeting the Fayed family, and they're connected to Dodi Fayed, Princess Diana's Dodi. And at the end of the British occupancy, all the land around the Giza Plateau was given to their grandfather. And so over the years, they really helped me a lot. They had property close into the plateau. Have you ever heard of the Champion?
I've not heard of the Champion, but the Fayed family, I think, did try to get us to Egypt a few years ago. Tell me about the Champion.
Okay, well, he was in charge of the plateau in the olden days when Zahi Hawass was a junior archaeologist who just had a bachelor's degree. And he was called the Champion because he used to run up the pyramid in 4 minutes and down in three. Now, I've climbed the pyramid a couple of times, and it takes about 45 minutes to get up there. It's really quite the climb. And so he and his sons, again, actually, you know, helped me do some things. And Champion had the keys to the pyramid at some point. And then over the years, Zahi Hawass got more and more power and more control. And But anyway, it was the champion. One day he summoned me, and he sent a little boy to get me to come for tea the next day. And I went, and he said, "I'm going to take you to the champ. To Zahi." And I said, "Okay." And I didn't know what he was going to say. And he was very, very old at this time.
Yeah. And was he Egyptian champion?
Oh, definitely, definitely. He's a Fayed.
Okay. All right.
Hefnawi Fayed.
Okay.
And so we got there, and I was, you know, very curious about being in the Department of Antiquities and meeting Zahi and all of that. But I really didn't know what our purpose was or why he felt so determined to bring me there. And so Zahi says, "What do you want?" And he says, "Well, you know who I was to you. I was your boss, and now you're in charge of everything. And it won't be long before I pass, and I have something, a favor to ask of you." And Zahi said, "What?" And Champion said, "Well, anything she asks you, I want you to say yes." And so that led to years of Zahi honoring that and saying yes to me when I asked for permission to do certain things. So,
well, and let me tell you, Carmen, that is a benefit that you just can't find anywhere.
That's right.
I mean, because he is tough. We've had him on the program before.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know how he believes that everything's Egyptian, regardless of the theories we've all had.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's Egyptian. And he's so focused on that, he doesn't want to hear anything outside of that.
Well, he asked me if I was a New Ager and, you know, what my profile was and all of that. But he did honor it, and I feel really good about it.
Well, we're going to get your take on how you think the pyramids were built. Now, tell me about your research when you were in Egypt. How did you do it?
Okay. Well, I started out with the Canadian Embassy in Cairo and the Egyptian Embassy in Ottawa, and I had written a manuscript, a second one after my book, Angels and Archetypes, or I was in the process of writing it. And I wanted to go into the archives of the National Museum, and the Cairo University Faculty of Archaeology Rare Books Library, and then the American University of Cairo Library. And so it was a lot of paperwork, and I finally got in there. And when I was walking around on Cairo University campus, of course, I was the only woman who didn't have my hair covered. But I spent a whole summer, because of all the Islamic energy and everything there, but I spent a whole summer being allowed to go into this rare books library, and it had all of the field notes of anyone who had ever done research on the Giza Plateau. So the books were in German, French, English, and Arabic. Of course, there was no filing system. There were just women who would bring me tea and piles of books and put them on the table. And there's big fans going because it was in the summer, and the pages were dark brown because they had, you know, been there because they're so old.
Yeah.
And I just started taking notes, and I found all kinds of interesting things in there. And they had to take records of how many barrels of sand had been removed and how many children and people had worked on the plateau in any given day, and actually what they found. And so even in the National Museum archives, there were some interesting things. And, of course, you have to be an archaeology student usually to get in there, or some kind of researcher. So it was very good to start or to do that part with the book research. But then later I wanted to do more field work and spend a lot of time on the Giza Plateau. And it wasn't very interesting to me to be there when the public was there. So I always wanted to go on the plateau after it closed. And so I'd spend up to 4 months in Egypt at a time and go on the plateau every night when it closed. And so that's how I started to gather a lot of the data.
When you're standing next to the Great Pyramid, maybe on the outside looking up it as far as you could see, what's it like? What's the feeling?
Well, first of all, it's huge. It's 2.3 million stones, and it covers several acres. And so however you see it from a picture, you know, we're about two stones high.
And, yeah.
You know, the rest of it's there. But what's also interesting is that when you're standing close to it, if you look across the sides of it, it's actually concave. And I'm told that if it had been flat, it would look like it was inflated somehow. And so it's fascinating. It's kind of like the columns in Greece, where the architecture of them is actually an optical illusion.
So they even understood that.
Oh, there's so much they understood. And in investigations now, and looking at Starry Night Pro and typing in various planets and stuff, that they knew a lot. And I'm still fascinated with how they put it together. I mean, you know, I just had a deck put in, and you know, the stones just on a 280 square foot paving stones, everything's crooked. And when you think, we can't build anything square today.
Yeah.
And when you think how precise it is, it's mind-boggling. And you can't put a razor blade between the stones. I mean, it's incredible.
Do you think they had high technology?
Absolutely. And the evidence of it, it's everywhere, but we're not looking for it because we're not used to things made out of stone being high technology. And we're taught that we're the smartest that we've ever been and we're the most evolved. And we call it the myth of progress and the Darwinian delusion. And so when we look at anything Egyptian, we go along with the story that they built it with chisels and that sort of thing, and slaves pulling stuff along on rope with ropes and on logs. And it's not even plausible that that's what happened.
Has Zahi argued with you about some of your thoughts and theories?
Well, actually, I've kept quite a low profile, and I haven't announced to him what I was doing. And no, I haven't talked to him about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll probably hear about this one tonight.
Oh, God.
Are you ready? You ready for that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. There's been so much written about the Great Pyramids, so many different theories, yet nobody really understands. You know, I'll remove you for a moment. Nobody really understands exactly what happened. Everybody has their own theories. I've heard poured theories to extraterrestrial theories to, there was a movement from within the pyramid where they pushed the blocks. We'll talk more about this, Carmen, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Dr. Carmen Bolter as we talk about the pyramids of Egypt and some of her theories. Carmen, why, yourself excluded, are so many theories out there about these pyramids and how they were constructed? I mean, all kinds of theories. How come?
Well, I think we're really curious about what the pyramids are doing there. We don't have the technology to build them today, and they are an object of fascination. There's more books written about the pyramids and Atlantis than probably any other subject known, and so we want to get to the bottom of it. But I think that the reason that we can't get to the bottom of it is we're looking at it through our own cultural lenses, through patriarchal ways of being and thinking that want to divide and conquer. And we also, have the tendency to want to be right. And so, if we say it's a poured theory, then we want, okay, we'll give all the reasons why that's true. But I think the problem is we're not looking at it in a larger context. Like, how did the pyramid fields work with one another? We get focused on the Great Pyramid, which is really important. But did you know that there's 6 pyramid sites with 22 pyramids, north and south, within a 12-mile distance of the Great Pyramid? Well, why? And Robert Bovall's talked to us about how the 3 pyramids of Giza are aligned to the Belt of Orion. Well, is that all? Is it a unified theory of more stars being connected? And the other thing is that we're told that the pyramids were built in 2450 BC. Maybe that was a time when they did the last restoration on it, but there perhaps was a lot of work done before that, and they were built in far more ancient times. But we're told the Bible tries to insist that we're 6,000 years old, and it's not a popular thing to look further back. And there's reasons for that. So I think it's important not to get bogged down with little details and look at the details as well. But I also think that it will help us understand what's going on and why if we look at it from a bigger perspective.
You said earlier that Edgar Cayce had a great influence on you when you were younger. Did you study at all his discussions of a hall of records by the base of the Sphinx while you were in Egypt these 23 some times, Carmen?
Absolutely. In fact, I had a center there, where a guest house, and I called it the Hall of Records Retreat Center. So it's very important. But again, we think, a lot of people think they're going to find a book written in English, in a chamber.
That's right.
And it's just not like that. It's the same thing as, there's 4,000 Egyptian hieroglyphs in hieroglyphic writing, and there's 26 letters, and we say, okay, this glyph is an A, this glyph is a B. Well, it's a completely different linguistic system. And we want to take everything we see and shove it into the paradigm that we're familiar with. And for sure, the ancient Egyptians are a really good example of something that wasn't waiting for English and us to happen when it developed.
Now, did you find because Zahi has not admitted this to me, anything that would show that there was a hall of records at the base of the Sphinx.
Yes, I would say. But it's going to be energetic and symbolic and not as concrete in the way. I think we found it, yes. I think the energetic signature is out. And also, when you say at the foot of the Sphinx, and we're talking underground, there's a network of underground passageways. And I think that that is one of the best kept secrets, and that has something to do with why that wall went up. There's a 20-mile all the way around the Giza Plateau wall that cost them millions and millions of dollars. I think they locked the door after the horse was stolen, to tell you the truth, but they really didn't want people to find out what was going on under there. And there's a lot of facts in the documentary series, The Pyramid Code, that have been verifiable and articles written and that sort of thing, but you're not going to find very much about what is actually underneath the Sphinx. Now, a lot of the field work that I did had to do with going inside the body of the Sphinx, and the watchmen were letting me go in there, and one time they opened the gate and they let me go in there all by myself. And for sure, it's a magnifier of energy, and even with a watchman standing there, you get the energy of his consciousness magnified as well. So it was really quite an experience to spend so much time largely alone and then totally alone, because there's various cavities. There's the inner chamber of the heart of the Sphinx, and there's different cavities that go on the left back rump of the Sphinx. It's a very narrow hole now, but I've been inside there, and there's all kinds of spiral chambers. But there's also old pictures, and this is what I ended up getting access to in the archives that I talked about in the last segment, of temples that were below the level of the legs of the Sphinx, like what it would be standing on. There's an old temple of Isis down there, and many, many passages. Well, the Department of Antiquities just cemented over the top of the whole thing and paved it. They're putting walls around it. Like, it's either they're in complete denial of the importance and even the fact that it's there, or they're really trying to cover something up. Now, I don't think we're going to get inside their minds about what they're actually doing, what they're hiding, or why. But that doesn't mean there isn't a whole network of passageways down there, because I spent 5 years in and out of holes. And, of course, over the centuries, they've been blocked. Lots of, you know, little passageways that go a certain way, but then you can see that it's been blocked recently. But
how
if
do
you
we,
go ahead.
Well, how do we know that the Egyptians haven't already been down there and that they pulled things out and they're hiding them somewhere?
Well, that's a tempting thought.
Yes, it is.
But the thing, I think we're focused on a thing.
Yes,
I
expect flying machines down there, Carmen, or tablets explaining the origin of life and things like that. That's what I expect.
Okay, but when we say tablets explaining the origins of life, we have that on the fresco walls, but we're not deciphering how they're talking about biology and cosmology. The Egyptians were very focused on how we got here and what happened after we left. They had no word for death, and they understood string theory, quantum physics, all of it, biomechanics, all of it. And we see that hidden in plain sight on the frescoes. Now, the other thing is that there was a lot of information that was drowned when the Aswan Dam flooded. There were 18 temples that were under the water. They knew Abu Simbel was going to go underwater. Then later the Temple of Isis would go three-quarters of the way underwater every time the Nile flooded. But there were 16 other temples that ended up completely submerged. And all the Nubian villages and people who had ancient wisdom, because they don't have a written language, they have a verbal language, they all had to move. But now UNESCO has had time to one by one get those temples out. And recently I was able to go on a cruise on the Aswan, behind the Aswan Dam, and visit some of these temples. And I've studied a lot of the frescoes that are in other temples, and there were some surprises there. There were some secrets that I hadn't seen before.
Such as?
The pharaoh inside the world tree, lots and lots of references to sacred cows, the sacred feminine, cattle cults, and that has to do with star maps and the Big Dipper and Hathor, but the connection to the Blue Lotus. And I can speak about those symbols a little later. But the point is you're saying you expect to find tablets. Well, there are tablets, some underground, some above ground. But a lot of the stuff that's in the passageways and inside the Great Pyramid aren't decorated, okay? And Chris Dunn talked about it being a machine. I'm very much into the idea that it was a huge system that functioned all together. Now, 3 years ago, you had William Henry on. I think it's ironic that he's going to be on tomorrow night.
Yes.
And he asked the question, if anybody knows how all of this worked together, I'd love it if they contacted me. And I just, you know, felt all kinds of energy come up about that, because that's the point. So just like we wouldn't put a decoration inside our oven, a lot of these passageways underneath aren't likely to have the tablets, okay? Full stop. When you said flying machines and spaceships, there was a lintel that fell off recently off a temple of above at the Temple of Abydos.
I've seen that tablet. If that's the same one you're talking about, absolutely incredible.
It's incredible, but think about it. There was something put over the top of it that then had more recent hieroglyphics. So what this lends itself to is the idea that we need to look at dynastic Egypt from 3113 BC until it ended in Cleopatra's time as the patriarchal part of Egypt. And then there were matriarchal cultures all over the world, and this is the subject matter of my book. I did many, many years of research on that. And so we have to look at epochs of time that go farther and farther and farther back. So if you we tend to think because ancient Egypt is the most ancient that we tend to know about, that we talk about, but the part that we're looking at is the recent part of Egypt. So they had different stages of corruption and less spirituality, and, mm-hmm. and you understand what I'm saying.
Sure.
And so in order to understand this story, I think we need to establish a much, much longer timeline. So having said that, when you look in Abydos, the Egyptians themselves had covered up those flying machines, and then you've got people saying that they were hieroglyphic embedded on top of another one, and they were various kings' inscriptions. Well, really, that's not what they look like. You know what they look like. They look like a helicopter. They look
helicopter,
like flying machines.
Submarines, everything.
Okay. So you're right that the flying machines, the secrets of biology and how we got here, the star maps and all of that were within the secrets of the Egyptians. But it's not hidden in the oven. It's hidden in plain sight.
Right.
And what's underneath is another secret.
Carmen, does this tell you that there was an ET visitation or a number of visitations from above?
Well, you know Graham Hancock,
uh-huh.
in his book Supernatural, he says we don't need extraterrestrials to explain any of this. We need interterrestrials. Okay, he talks about the altered states of consciousness that led to visions, and he talks about perianthropes, which are half animal and half human. Well, when we put the spin on it, we say the Egyptians were obsessed with death and they worshipped animals. But that's not what we're looking at, okay? So, I mean, it's a big question, and I'm not willing to step out and say they were or they weren't here in visitations. Like, and you've had enough to do with UFOs to say, well, they are here, and some people have seen them. And when you're lying in your bed and you've been abducted, maybe you had an inner journey and you came back with scars. I mean, we get confused inside the semantics of what we're talking about. I think that when they talk about conversations with the elders or the wise ones, they talk about connections to Sirius and Osiris, and that has to do with Orion and Isis and all of that. I got those backwards, but you know what I mean. Isis and Osiris representing Sirius and Orion. To what extent, and we talk about channeled work and, you know, remote viewing and all of that. So there's a way to paint this picture where something that is outside of three-dimensional physical reality can exist if we expand our consciousness, okay? But we've got a big taboo about that sort of thing.
Sure do.
And
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the Egyptians obviously cultivated altered states of consciousness deliberately, and they learned how to navigate the bardos. So when it came time for death, they didn't get all surprised. They knew how to consciously go. So weaving all of this into the way they lived, they also knew how to depart. And so there's what I'm trying to do here is explain it in a way where we can understand them, but they were well versed in out of body experiences and consciousness.
Do you believe that the way the Egyptians handled death, though they never really talked about death per se, convinces us today that there is a hereafter?
Absolutely. Well, when you go into the Valley of the Kings, the inscriptions on the walls that no one's allowed to take pictures of are giving the map of the bardos. They're explaining what happens. Now, why they kept their organs and put them into perfume jars and the canopic jars and how they decorated their tombs wasn't the idea that they were going to reincarnate and go find their tomb and get their stuff. I mean, we think of them as misguided and infantile and kind of a little off, right? But there were reasons for this, because if the physical body was attended to, the old physical body was attended to, the ka, the spirit body, the ba, would be free to roam and choose a new incarnation at will. And so they weren't forced to come back unnecessarily. And, you know, you've talked about ghosts and all kinds of things where it's a lower level soul where things didn't end well and they're trapped. And that's not the same thing as a high-level ascended master channeled being. You understand what I'm saying? And
sure.
So they were trying to allow themselves to navigate these other realms and then reincarnate in a way that would progress them in terms of levels of consciousness.
Did you come across anything that would have backed up the work of Zechariah Sitchin in his work with Sumerian tablets?
Well, yes, and I've met Sitchin. And now the thing is that there's, and again, Coast is a wonderful forum for exploring a lot of these things, and there are scholars since that have looked at little syntactical differences in the way that Zechariah Sitchin interpreted grammar in the Sumerian text that slightly change how it's interpreted. But he was basically talking about the wars of gods and men. And this is far-out stuff. And hardly anybody has tackled what Sitchin has tackled. And it seems to float in its own little pocket. You understand what I mean by that, I'm sure. That how do we take the idea of the Nephilim and reptilian race and, you know, the wars of gods and men out there and how it affected us here? Well, personally, and it fits into the visions I've had as well, let's imagine that the Golden Age was in full swing. We're in, you know how the processional cycle works, every 13,000 years. So we're in the deepest, densest, darkest, ready to turn the corner back up into the next Golden Age. So every 13,000 years, we go down, and 13,000, we go up, and then 26,000 years added to that, so 39,000 years ago, we would have been at a peak Golden Age. And so let's imagine we were in full swing and the energy machines were working and people had high levels of consciousness and senses of peace and all of that. And then something happens and we're taken over by a darker force that overcharges the machines. And like if you go into the Great Pyramid and the Pyramids of Dahshure, you'll see these incredible cracks inside. And it would have taken a huge force. Well, I don't think if everything was going along as it should in the Golden Age, the interruption would have happened in a way that would have destroyed or hurt, not completely destroyed, but damaged the energy system. And so, yes, I think that something happened that was evil, if you will, that affected something that probably was quite peaceful. Now, if I was going to describe that, I would probably not make a documentary series, but I would make a feature film that was more speculative, and we would paint a story that seemed more like a fantasy, because we can't prove that, right?
Oh, I want to get into your pyramid code when we come back at the top of the hour, Carmen, and some of the other work that you've been doing. This has been a lifelong effort for you, hasn't it?
It sure has.
No end in sight?
Oh, actually, you know what? I feel pretty satisfied now. Now that it's all on DVD and tidy little packages and edited, I feel quite complete, to tell you the truth.
Finally.
Yeah.
All right. Well, stay with us. We're going to be back with Dr. Carmen Bolter in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Her website, pyramidcode.com. Carmen, when you were in Egypt, did you see, at least around the pyramids, what could have been construed as incredible wealth during those days?
Oh, yeah. Did you know that around the Saqqara pyramid, the Step pyramid, and in front of the second pyramid, there was a quartz crystal floor that was maybe 8 inches thick, maybe a lot thicker than that. And during the 1700s and prior to that in the 700s, those floors were just quarried. People were allowed to go on the plateau and just take stones to build mosques and churches and whatever they wanted. And there are a few chunks, and if you look up close, you'll see that they actually break into quartz crystals. Pardon?
It's exciting stuff.
It really is. And then basalt floors, and you can see that they used to be polished, and they're in pretty good shape considering how old they are. And these were like really solid structures. And a lot of people go to Egypt and stand right on these floors and stand in front of the pyramid and don't even notice. And so I've got some pretty good footage of these structures. But also around the wall, if you're looking at the Step pyramid, you can see a few uraeus that were left. Well, they had ruby eyes, and there's probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 of them. But they used to go all the way around this huge courtyard that had a quartz crystal floor. I mean, the opulence was incredible. Now, there's a lot of speculation about whether or not the Great Pyramid had a capstone, and it's my understanding now that it hasn't had a capstone for a long time, but when the casing stones were on there, in the distant past, it actually had a gold capstone that shimmered in its own, had its own energy, and that was part of how the pyramid functioned as well.
Robbers got the capstone?
I don't know about that. I think it was such a long time ago it could have been taken off because, again, the energy was shifting and things went into the etheric plane. I mean, all of this sounds a bit far out, but I really think that there were stages that are so beyond what we can understand if we're looking with our own patriarchal lenses. I wouldn't say it was robbers. I would say it was a decision that took it off. But the other thing is that the incredible amount of gold, I mean, even during the Amarna period, but the furniture that was buried with King Tut, there was a tremendous amount of gold. Now, probably they were transmuting other substances through the use of alchemy and creating the gold. There's information about that as well, the transmutation of the atom that was, you know, they weren't just mining it, if you will, because it's kind of like electroplating. But, the jewels, and the crystals and the stonework and all of that were signs of huge wealth and opulence. Beautiful stuff.
Let's talk about the pyramid code. Now, keep in mind, Carmen, Zahi Hawass probably has his ear to his radio somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But tell me a little bit about the pyramid code. What is the code?
Well, first of all, I have to send Zahi a copy because that was one of the conditions that I got the permit to
okay.
In Egypt. So he's going to see it.
It's on the way, Zahi. It's on the way.
Yeah, it hasn't been finished that long, so I'm not overdue sending it. Okay, so what it is a documentary series of 5 television hours, and each episode is distinct, and it's going through the process. The first episode is called The Band of Peace, and it's looking at these 22 pyramids that are in the 6 distinct sites, speculating about how they could have been used, and then it grows and progresses into high-level technology, and we're looking at some instruments that there's absolutely no way they could have been made with chisels. I don't even know if we could create something like the Schistix today that is just absolutely so refined, but we've got high-definition footage of all of these instruments and speculations about how they could have been used. The third episode is called Sacred Cosmology, and it goes into we go on an expedition in the desert to a very ancient site called Napta Playa, and that has astronomical mm-hmm. alignments that are similar to what came later in pharaonic times. Now, what's ironic and sad about that is that since we took that footage, the site has had quite a bit of damage from people just driving jeeps right over the top of the microlithic stones. And I don't know that anybody had taken high-definition footage of it in the first place. So, you know, when you think that some of the footage we have, the sites have been destroyed, it's pretty spectacular that we managed. I mean, I think if we started over again right now, it would be impossible to get some of that stuff. And then the Sacred Cosmology episode goes into what did they know in terms of science. And we have Laird Scranton, who's talking about new interpretations of hieroglyphic that goes a step beyond what Champollion had reported way back, and he was one of Napoleon's men. And it's not that Champollion was wrong, it's just that there's multiple layers of meaning, and it can go deeper than that, and that gives an explanation of just how sophisticated they were. They understood string theory. They understood the Calabi-Yau space, which is something that physicists are just starting to grasp. And Laird Scranton talks about if you go to Stephen Hawking and ask him how many levels there are in the quantum string theory, he'll say about 200, and if you go to a Dogon priest, he'll say 266. So it's fascinating that this knowledge has been preserved. He's speculating that the Dogons may have been a class of priests that left Egypt during the Islamic takeover because they didn't want to be exposed to that, and they migrated all the way over to Mali in East Africa, and they kept the traditions alive, they kept the way they spoke alive and the symbols alive, and they relate directly to the hieroglyphic text. So that's pretty exciting stuff. The fourth episode is called The Empowered Human, and that's looking at how the ancients would have had 360 senses, much, much higher levels of consciousness, and how that functioned. So who they were and what they were doing. So what I'm trying to do is paint a socio-cultural, spiritual context mm-hmm. for who we might have been in a golden age. So it's not just saying they had a lot of stuff. It's basically saying that there was a rhyme and a reason and a training and a way that they were able to access these higher levels of consciousness. And the last episode is a new chronology, which is saying, okay, well, if this is possible, when was it possible? Because looking in recent history in 2450 BC when they say the pyramids were built, it just doesn't add up. There's too many problems with it. Now, the other thing is that we've had a couple of world floods since, you know, the ancient times.
Yes.
And so when they say, well, if they had diamond drill bits, where are they? Well, you know, a little tiny diamond drill bit isn't going to survive two floods and 50,000 years or however long it was. So we have to, you know, really think in different terms and in terms of how do we prove it. And so we bring in the concept of archaeoastronomy. And so, you know, and that is so. One of the things that I'm bringing in as well is a multidisciplinary approach. Now, what patriarchal ways of being and thinking have done is divided and conquered. So university departments don't speak to one another. And so geology can't speak to large cycles of time and weather patterns and doesn't speak to linguistics. And you know what I'm saying? When you get, you know, little clues and crumbs from astrophysicists and from geologists and archaeologists and anthropologists, then you can start to weave a larger story together. But, you know, one of the things about the way formal research is conducted on the Giza Plateau is it has to be archaeologists from Egypt. And if you're an anthropologist, you can't get permits. And they divide it all up. So, you know, it's a really big puzzle that we're putting together. And that's what the contribution that the Pyramid Code, I think, is hopefully making. And so it's stretching us to think of things in a different way. And I think that if, you know, people were high-level initiates and are reincarnated from there, they're probably going to watch it and go, I knew it. So it really is meant to be a trigger to those who already know. And it's pretty exciting, you know, because it's also, you know, got an original soundtrack, and it's very easy to watch whether you know it already or not. So it appeals to a large audience. But it's also building scaffolding so that we can hang a different perspective of what the Egyptians might have been. And it certainly has a lot of original material in it and some interviews with people that you have interviewed before. More than half of the interviews are Coast interviewees. And, yeah, I think, yeah, it's really something.
What's your venue, DVDs for the five shows, or are you getting it on television?
Well, we have quite a lot of screeners out, and there's no TV formal deal yet, and we decided to go ahead and let the DVD be produced, and
okay.
It will be released October 28th, but there's pre-orders being taken now on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and the distributors, that's Culture International. And so whether or not it comes out on TV before then, it will be available on DVD,
great.
And that'll be for Christmas.
Let's go back to some of your research, Carmen, some of the beginning of it. You believe that the Nile ran alongside the pyramids. Tell me about this. And how did you conclude this?
Well, you've talked to Hakim, I think, as well, and he's an indigenous mm-hmm. wisdom keeper that passed away a year ago. And I studied with him for 12 years. And he insisted on the idea of the migration of the Nile. Now, we've got aerial footage in the Pyramid Code, and I've spent a lot of time digging around on the plateau myself. And you can see where the riverbed would have gone. And you can also see when you look at Google Earth how the edge of the plateau and the fertile band along the Nile is exactly parallel to where the Nile has migrated now 8 miles away. But if you look further west, where you get the El Cargo Oasis and Daklo Oasis and all of that, it also is roughly parallel. And so we can think of geological time, like how long would it take for a river to migrate 8 miles? Well, how long would it take for it to migrate 50 miles? And so if we reckon, and it makes sense, you know, people build cities on the edge of water. And so, it fits together pretty strongly. And then right now, well, the last time I was in Egypt was in April, in front of the Sphinx, you can see the water table is rising again. And it's happening. It's there. And so, and you can also see from the fertile band where it's lush and green, and then when it's desert, that this is all related. And so, yes, I think it makes a lot of sense. And then you see the causeways would have gone right up to the water, and if you were on a barge, you'd just walk right up onto the causeway into the temples. So painting that is very satisfying, and we've actually created some very, very good 3D animations that reconstructs that. And it's so satisfying for me to see it that way because I just feel like my whole soul relaxes and goes, finally, that's the way it used to look. And so, yeah, I'm convinced. And then that also contributes to the notion that it couldn't have been 2450 BC because it wasn't long enough for the river to migrate.
That's exactly right. How did they move the blocks? Millions of blocks. How did they move those things?
Okay. Well, first of all, we call them sea trains here, light rapid transit. I'm looking for the word. Every city has their own little trains that go.
And they call, we in St. Louis, they call it the Metrolink.
The Metro. Okay, fine.
You know,
one train is 9 tons. Okay. Now
right.
Imagine a group of us sitting in our house and go outside, and we're going to be taking a train a minute and putting it on the roof, just us. And then, well, what if we had 2.3 million of these trains, right? And where are we going to stand when we're lifting them up and putting them on the roof?
Exactly.
You know, so this idea of ramps doesn't make any sense. These stones were 20, 40, up to 200 tons. These trains are 9 tons, right? So,
yeah.
You know, like, so there is, we don't have, even if we had all the cranes on the Giza Plateau. They've tried to reconstruct pyramids with cranes and with our technology, and they can't do it.
They can't do it.
And I don't know if you saw that show. I got such a kick out of it, and they were reconstructing Stonehenge, and they built it out of styrofoam, and they had to, you know, have this huge area where they did it and then ship it to try to erect it. And they were having the hardest time. They were so proud of themselves because they did it, but they weren't working with stone. They were working with styrofoam. And they still couldn't do it.
They still couldn't do it. That's
okay,
right.
So the only answer is anti-gravity. And, well, then you think, well, how did they do that? And so that is a form of levitation. And so I've had visions of how this worked, but it also fits with the Hindu Vedic tradition of SIDHIS, S-I-D-H-I-S, which are bilocation, manifestation, alchemy. There's six of them, and they all involve the transmutation of the atom. Now, if you think about back to what Chris Dunn was saying and other, and this makes sense to me, that there was a charge that was building in the underground passageways. The passageways were limestone aquifers, mm-hmm. and then there was a honeycomb, which is the five-sided honeycomb shape of also man-made passages under. The water was running there. It built a charge. The way the pyramids were insulated with the casing stones ended up having stones of high conductivity and stones of low conductivity interfacing with each other like a conducted an insulated wire, building a charge. So the water molecules would go through granite passageways, which granite is a transmission stone. It's got crystal in it, and it emits radon gas. And so what you've got is these zigzag patterns, Emoto has done work with, if you keep you pour water from one to the other, one side to the other, and they were using this in Bolivia and Tiwanaku and the Acapana Pyramid. So all of these techniques were being used in other places. So anyway, the water builds a charge, and blows apart, and then you've got the oxygen and the hydrogen. Well, our physical bodies are also 70% water. And so there's a way that we could build a charge in our own bodies. And so there's the human divining rod function, where high-level initiates that were able to handle a huge capacity of energy through their bodies, the energy coming through the pyramids, through pyramid fields, through the limestone aquifers, and through these passageways that go all the way to Saqqara and probably all the way to Deshur, all the way on the north side of Abu Roush, and all this is diagrammed and there's animations of it in the pyramid code. All of this working together with sound and light technology, in addition to what's called the Schist disk. Are you familiar with that?
No, tell me about that.
It was found by Walter Emery, and again, there's pictures of diagrams of how it worked. Hollow thing in the middle, something that looks very much like a propeller, only the blades are flat. But if you know, we can lift a plane up with them, and fan a room. If they're tilted, so it's similar technology, and then they had these stone tubes that would fit over the top, and these would spin, and this is Hakim who would talk about this, and it would drone. It was at 8 megahertz, the frequency of the Earth. So imagine hundreds of initiates who were trained to handle a huge amount of energy, all of this water being charged through sound and light technology, and the droning of the Schist disk with, and there's a magnifier that's with it, and this is all in the Egyptian Museum, and several of them relaying, and then they had the Walter Emery found these crystal bowls at Abu Ghraib. I mean, all of this would be much better if you can see it in action, but these incredibly laser-cut bowls that actually look like satellite dishes, so relaying from one site to the other. So you can imagine the huge amount of energy that they were able to build a charge with, and then it actually was able to transmute the atom, and that's where you get levitation.
Now, in order, though, Carmen, to, let's say, get these huge blocks up, you know, hundreds of feet into the air in order to get them way up at the top, this whole area must have been that way, right?
Well, that's the point. Like, I call it the band of peace. And so when you think of a 12 to 15-mile expanse with 22 pyramids with hundreds of initiates around each one and the cavities inside the pyramids each having their own resonant tone. So it's like if you've ever seen a wind harp.
Oh, sure. And let's talk more about this. And also I want to get your take on Coral Castle down in Florida that 102-pound man, Edward Leed Skaldin, developed. We'll get back to the levitation. Do you also think that they might have used sound, Carmen, some kind of resonance in order to vibrate these blocks?
Well, absolutely. And what I was saying just before the break was that the chambers inside the pyramids weren't tombs. They never found a mummy there, any mummies in any pyramids ever, and that doesn't deter people who want to believe that. But each of the chambers is shaped differently, and each of the angles of the pyramids are at a different angle, and then there's three different chambers in most of the pyramids, and so they create a harmonic within themselves. And most people who have been there, who've toned a little bit, hear this, well, Paul Horn and all of that. It is incredible resonance that goes in. So if they're anything, they are sound devices. And it everything was about vibration. And it still is, even, you know, the vibration of sound of how our voice sounds. We can tell if someone's angry or upset, not depending on the words, but depending on the sound. And so, yes, that was a key. Sound and light technology was key.
How did they know how to do this? We can't even do it now.
Well, we're at the lowest end of we're in a dark, dark age right now. And we're unplugged and dumbed down and, you know, pharmaceutically drugged and all of that. And so, and told, full of propaganda and full of fear. And so we have the least capacity to understand this or do this. And even so, there's lots of people that are curious that on some level are fascinated by all of this. So on some level, we want to know, we hope it's possible. But if we kind of erase the board and think of empowered human beings who functioned in a different way, who had different values, who had different disciplines, then we can start to paint the picture. It's meant to be secret, I think. Even in the golden age times when they were doing this, I think there was a populace outside of that that were in the fields, you know, doing regular farming kinds of activities, and that the whole population wasn't involved in high-level initiations, but it was considered really important work. And these were energy to feed the people, power to generate an energy field on the whole planet, and we invest a whole lot of energy now in hydroelectric plants, and because we know there's going to be a big return. And so I think there was a system that did support this sort of thing. And it's fantastic. And, you know, we're speculating, of course. We can't say for sure, but we have to have all our pixels in order and look at the instruments that we have and the evidence that we have. Like if you think about the amount of crystal that I described before, and it's everywhere. Think about we've got crystals in our watches. Crystal oscillators makes a CD-ROM work, a radio work. Everything is run by crystals and teeny tiny little bits. So if you magnify this by hundreds of square feet, 8-10 inches deep, and it's here, here, and here, and here, vibrating off the pyramid, off the sound, off the, you know, like it starts to make a little bit of sense. Like, you know, we don't have to understand how a radio works to turn it on and dial the station and listen to it. But, you know, it's a fact that pretty much everything we have that's electronic, Ethernet cables, everything's run with crystals.
How did we lose the technology, though, passed down? I mean, there's this massive gap, Carmen, where we don't know anything.
Yep.
Where did it go? What happened to it?
Okay. Well, this is a great question, and you've interviewed Walter Cruttendon, and he talks about us being in a binary star system, possibly with Sirius. Now, again, he is speculating and wondering and all of that, and he's saying that the binary system, and again, we need diagrams for this, but he's shown that in his great year, and if you can imagine an orbit for the Earth and an orbit for Sirius, and them kind of being oblong, and when we're the farthest away, we're going slow, and then when we come back together and go close, then we're it speeds up. I'm drawing with my hands, but you can't see me.
See, what you don't know is, yes, I can.
Oh, good.
We have technology too.
We have telepathy. When we're in the quickening, when we're closer, it's almost like a magnet being strong when it's closer. Then we are in a golden age, and when we're at the farthest outreaches of this orbital cycle, then we're weak. So the resonance patterns, the magnetism is weak. And so we end up weak. We're weak-brained, we're feeble. And so in the golden age, we have more of a propensity to be able to handle this and be on. Okay? Now what's happening is 2012 is the demarcation point where we're just about to turn and go back into the light and climb our way through. But one of the metaphors that I really like is that as we're approaching winter solstice, and it's getting darker and darker, it may not be as bad in California, but certainly up in Canada, in Calgary, where I've been living, you know, when it gets darker and darker and darker. It's just, it's almost like we're being squeezed and contracted.
Yeah.
And then we hit solstice, and we get 5 more minutes of light a day, and another 5, and another 5, and we start to feel better. And so this is the point that is upon us. 2012 isn't about doomsday, it's about turning a corner, and it's about the end of this horrible, dark bloodbath being coming to an end. Now, that doesn't mean that the collective unconscious is going to just let go and go, yippee, we're heading toward the golden age. There's still a lot of patterns that are in place that are going to hold us there. But that's why we can't remember. Because it's just like, you know, the light still works, but when it's unplugged, if you don't know that you got to stick those prongs in the wall, or if the electricity grid goes down, so what if you plug it in, it doesn't work? Now, here's what I think. We had 2 big floods, you know, at 11,500 BC or somewhere in there. Plato talks about it, or 11,500 years ago. I never remember that one. But anyway, think about it.
And then the big one from Noah.
If we're living in a house where it's cold out and the grid goes down, how long are we going to last in the house?
Not long.
I have to leave, go find a cave, light a fire, find another way to live. Now, we don't have our stuff anymore. That doesn't mean we didn't have a computer yesterday and we don't know how to use it. It means we lost our stuff and the grid went down, right? So what would we do if we were really into astronomical configurations and understanding how the flooding would happen, and the flooding of the Nile would happen with the rising of Sirius, and the planet goes down below the horizon and then comes back up, and all of the mythology that we've talked to or know about from the pyramid texts is all speaking about these cycles. So if it was you and me and a bunch of our friends and we found each other at the mouth of the cave, wouldn't we start putting stones up, stone circles, and starting over again, marking that?
Sure.
Right. So what's Napta Playa? And when is it dated to? It's dated to after the flood. And there's another circle like 500 kilometers away, and they're dotted all over the place. And so we'd start over with what we had. And so I think what happened is the grid went down.
The grid went down. That's not bad. Or, as I think, what if they just merely packed up and left?
Well, I, if there was an opportunity to evacuate and pack up and leave and the ship came along, I'd probably want to get on, would you?
Enough. I'd get on as long as my loved ones were with me.
Well, exactly. And if they didn't want to go, we'd make camp and start over.
We'd stay. Absolutely.
And
there's just, you know, Carmen, you've done a remarkable job, by the way. And I've interviewed a lot of people, as you just said. I think you're as close than anybody I've talked to about what possibly might have happened, how they built these. When I look at what Edward Leeds Scullin, are you familiar with him? Coral
Absolutely.
Castle? Okay.
Sure.
I mean, he died in 1951. Always said he knew the secrets of the pyramids, and he was obsessed with magnetism. I think it's very close to what you've said. I think he knew about this, and he did the same thing.
And the operative word is secret.
Yes.
Right?
He kept it a secret.
We're not supposed to tell everybody, you know, and this wasn't for everybody because it could have been misused. And I think somewhere along the line there was a little bit of rough and tumble, and it did get misused. And the power was there. And you'll see, if you look at the footage on the pyramid code, these cracks. How can you make a crack in a solid piece of rock that big? And there's one in the Grand Gallery of the Great Pyramid, and the side of the sarcophagus got blown out in the King's Chamber, and they've stuck a fan inside the crack on the wall. And then in Dashur, there's weird chemical marks in there. So let's imagine that these were really big operating machines that used a completely different kind of technology, implosion energy, not explosion energy, and all of that, and they malfunctioned, it would crack the thing apart. But, you know, the pyramids are un-Islamic, and they wanted to take them down. And we don't have the technology to take them down. And the other thing is, when they finally got into the pyramid, it was forced entry. Charles Piazzi Smith used explosives to get in. And they didn't find mummies in there. They found white powder. They found chemical stuff. So it was like a closed chemical machine that just kept on perpetuating itself, right? Like, you don't go open up your car battery and start messing with it. It just works. And then when you need a new one, you put a new one in.
You put a new one in.
You don't open it up and say, well, what's in here?
Well, and at least in the old days, we used to. We don't do that anymore.
Right,
we
but there's closed circuits that you don't interrupt, you replace. like a light bulb. You don't go in there and open it up and start fiddling with it. It's a closed circuit. And I think that that's what the pyramid was.
Could the power have been abused and maybe it sank Atlantis, for example?
Uh-huh. I think so.
Yeah.
And we knew that was coming, too. I mean, like I say, we, because many people who are incarnated now were incarnated in Egypt and were incarnated in Atlantis. Now, the Council of Nicene in 300 AD or whatever, they decided to outlaw reincarnation. So no one was allowed to talk about it anymore. And then the demonization of the feminine and Mary Magdalene and all of that. Okay, so we're just going to, and then anything that was tarot or numerology or astrology or magic or alchemy or plant magic or any of that, oh, well, we're going to kill anybody who's into that, right? And then the cellular memory, you know, and people get afraid and then they think it's all weird. Well, I'm here to tell you, weird isn't weird anymore. On some level, we're coming into a more refined energy and we're in it together to remember. And everybody has brought their puzzle piece. And my quest has been to create a context that the puzzle pieces can fit in so that everybody's contribution starts to add up to something.
That's remarkable. Good work, by the way. Good work. Now, give me the percent. How accurate do you think you are? How right do you think you are?
Okay, now, I got a PhD, and when you say it could be, it may be, from the information we have now, it looks like, because in 20 years, there may be another piece that comes along, and we're missing a big piece. But from what we've got right now, it's at least feeling good. Now, when you combine all the things we've talked about tonight, you know, ghosts and, you know, all kinds of things, disincarnate, altered states of consciousness, all those bits and pieces, I think we're starting to approach, especially if you allow it to go into the far, far distant past, maybe not this golden age, but the golden age before it or the one before that. And we just aren't trained to think of it as that far back as that. And so, you know, it's vague. It's almost, you know, it's like a smoke and mirrors, if you will, and it clusters into something. And I can't tell you if I'm right or not. It feels good.
You know, I was going to ask you if you would have lived during this era, but you did.
I'm sure of it. I started remembering it when I was a little girl. And the other thing is that I had a vision of this place in Egypt, the temple, and I went looking for it. And I, you know those games you play when you're kids, I'm getting warm, I'm getting cool. No, I'm getting cool. I'm getting warm. It's around here somewhere. And I'd leave and come back and have more and think, well, maybe I'm just making it all up and I'd have more visions and I'd go back. It was 10 years. Of, no, this isn't it. No, this isn't it. And then when I found it and my bare foot touched the real stone of the real place, everything was like a movie. The lights all went on and I could smell the flowers and see the robes of the priestesses and I knew around the corner there was a little door and there sure was. Well, what's the difference between 10 years of no and an overwhelming yes? A lot. And that's not the only time that I had a quest like that. There was other things in other places in Greece and whatnot, and at Amarna in other places in Egypt, right? And it's like when the vision, it's like when you finally get the puzzle piece and it clicks in, and then there's the whole picture. It's unmistakable. You can't deny that no is no and yes is yes. And that's how divining rods work and pendulums. The energy is either contracting or moving away from, or it's opening up and saying yes.
Now, some of the technology that you were talking about that they used for carving and things like that, now this is even beyond the levitation. There's some knowledge there, Carmen. Unless, you know, if Michael Cremo's correct, that civilizations are millions and millions of years old, then it's conceivable, as I've always thought, that we had incredible technology then, just based on a lifestyle progression, and then we lost it all because we blew ourselves up.
Yep.
And it's gone. And there is historical references to some kind of nuclear explosion.
Exactly. And the Dead Sea, if you look at it from space, it's this huge, you know, and there's radiation stuff going on there too. Absolutely. And the Hindu texts, in the Vedic tradition, they talk about nuclear. They talk about nuclear activity. We're told not to read those books. We're told they're crazy. You know, people get killed for thinking it or in the past. Well, maybe still, but you know, like we have. So we've got our hands and legs tied. We can't move forward because we don't have all the pieces, or the pieces are erased, or well, he's off the mark, or they're not in our department, or whatever. But if you take the whole thing and open it up and include Michael Cremo and all of these other people, you know, it really makes sense. And the other thing, I was going to come back to a point about Walter Cruttenden. He never says he's right, but then I got Starry Night Pro, and I plugged in Sirius and the Earth and the extragalactic grid, and I ran it for 50,000 years back and 50,000 years forward. And Sirius is right in the center of the extragalactic grid, and everything about the Earth rotates around it. I knew in 5 minutes that he was probably right.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so he didn't run Starry Night Pro to find that out, but he sure did his homework. Right?
It is absolutely riveting to assume that mankind was so advanced at one time, and we're the primitive ones now.
But it's the same thing. I mean, I hate to bring up this point, but global warming. I had snow on my deck in June and in July and in August in Calgary, Alberta. I moved to Victoria.
We're in a cycle. You know that. I know
but
that.
But they keep telling us warming, and they think we're not going to notice we're cold. It's propaganda. Maybe it's warm somewhere, but it sure hasn't been warm where I've been. And it was cold in Florida. It was cold in Egypt. I mean, they think if they keep telling us the opposite, that we'll believe it. Well, that means we have to be really dumbed down for that.
Anyway. Well, do you think possibly when we went to the moon in 1969, we went back to the moon in 1969? I think we might have already been there a long time ago.
With all the secrecy, why are we left guessing when it's our tax dollars that end up paying for these things?
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Why the secrecy? What are they afraid of? If they said mankind is millions of years old, we had technology then, we now can prove it, we have found things, and something horrible happened to this planet, whether it was man-made or whether it was coming from space in the form of an asteroid or something like that. So tell us that. Or do they panic? Do they think we think that's going to be our fate, and so they don't want us to know about it?
I'm going to come from a different place to answer this.
All right, go for it.
Nikola Tesla.
Yes.
He understood this implosion energy. And in the early 1900s on Long Island, he built the Tesla Tower. And he was funded by J.P. Morgan, and what they had was descending passages and a limestone aquifer underneath, and he was all ready to give wireless, free radio, telecommunications, and electricity to humanity. And Edison was there wanting a controlled monopoly.
Yes.
Look how much we pay for utilities and for gas. Do you know that today a liter of gas in Egypt is 20 cents? We're paying $1.10 or whatever here.
Amazing.
Okay. And I lived in Taiwan for a while. You run a landline for $1.58. Air conditioning for a whole month for $9.
Carmen, let's take phone calls when we come back. This is a fast night. Plus, I want to get your take. We briefly touched on those incredible, incredible sketchings of Abydos. I want to talk about those. Carmen, before we take the many calls rolling in here for you, let's talk a little bit more about Abydos and get your thoughts on that. Now, when you said that the Egyptians covered them up, hid them, what were they trying to do?
Well, I think that there was a deterioration in consciousness from the high level, even within Egyptian culture. And another thing that's a fact is that Egyptian tour guides are sworn to secrecy, that they're not going to tell the public about them. So most people don't know where these are. So the threat has been there, you know, that Hatshepsut and Nefertiti and Akhenaten and Tut, you know, were remembering things about the real spirituality. And I think it's similar to the way, you know, the church has become more corrupt, and there's a difference between true spirituality and religion, which is, you know, relying on a source outside of yourself instead of relying on empowerment from within. So the distinction between patriarchal ways of being and thinking is power over, which is very different from matriarchal ways of being and thinking. That's about empowerment. So matriarchy is not the opposite of patriarchy, where women control men, right? And so yeah. I think that as the energy became denser and denser, there's always been pockets of people that certain people that come through that remember the old times or represent the old times. And I think that's why Hatshepsut, Akhenaten, and Tut were erased from the king's list at Abydos, right? That's yep. where the king's list is. The other thing at Abydos is it's on a water table, and the Assyrian behind it is much, much deeper. Well, we know from archaeological stuff that the upper stuff is newer, the deeper stuff is older, and in Egypt it's evident that big stones are deep, and the little teeny tiny stones are at the top. And so Abydos is a really good place that represents these layers of time. And I don't know if you're familiar with the book, The Search for Om Seti.
Yes.
Okay. Well, she, you know, similar story. She had to go to Egypt, and she ended up being a mail order bride and got there and worked on the plateau for a while and ended up at Abydos. And she was working in archaeology, and she'd tell the guys, if you dig there, you're going to find a tree root. And if you dig there, you're going to find water. And when she got to Egypt, she kicked off her shoes, and she was remembering, right? And so this happens to certain individuals, and Abydos has got layers and layers. But in the Temple of Seti, there's lots and lots and lots of symbols of how they understood. And there's blue, yellow, and red beings, which may be representing coming from Sirius, Orion, and being here. So I think there's multiple layers of stories that exist there. And so possibly the true story was in that very temple. And someone came along and felt threatened. Because like with the Amun priesthood, there was a thing called the ceremony of the weighing of the hearts, where you'd die and they would say, okay, you're dead, let's have your heart. You'd be met by Anubis and you'd have to put your heart against the feather of truth on a scale. If your heart was heavy because you had done immoral things or killed someone or whatever, they didn't want you on the other side, right? So it was a lesson to the populace to live light of heart, right? But then in the later images of the Amun priesthood with the ceremony, they have Horus with his hand on the scale, and you could buy your salvation like going to confession in the Catholic Church. And so you could get Shakti dolls, and this would ensure that you would get to go to the other side. Well, that's still corrupt, and someone was making money to say that you're free. So when Nefertiti and Akhenaten said, you know what, we don't like this game anymore. We want to go to somewhere and start over and do real spirituality, they still say that he was heretic and crazy and deformed and had diseases and everything, and it was a failed experiment. And then they went back to the Amun priesthood making all the money, where people had to give half their harvest to ensure their salvation. Well, isn't that sounding like what we've got now, paying 50% of our taxes or our salary to taxes? It's the same thing. And aren't people threatened in the same way that people will be empowered and that people will think for themselves and have altered states and all of that? Right?
Good job. You got it. To the phones we go. Houston, Texas. Troy, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Troy.
Good evening. It is an honor. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. You are so clear, Carmen. You are my new hero. You really are. I admire everything you're saying tonight. It's very exciting, and it just makes a lot of sense. I have two small questions before one big question, and I will be quick. Did you say that there's just one age of light each 26,000 years, or do we get to have that twice? I wasn't sure about your take on that.
26,000 years, one golden age, and we're at the bottom of the cycle in the darkest.
Okay. Now, were you talking earlier about other pyramid sites linking together in the area?
Yes.
Okay, great. Something popped in my head. I just thought I'd ask it as a question. And it kind of comes from this book I read, Gods of the Dawn by Peter Lemassurier.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a graph in there that examines the mass of the Earth and Venus and the Moon and the Mars. And he shows how they're all related. And he also shows an extra pyramid and the third pyramid. One's the size of the Moon, one's the size of the Mars. So in my mind, I'm wondering if the other pyramids up and down the Nile, maybe it all links together all of the other planets in our solar system and quite possibly Nibiru as well, and inhabitable moons. And I was just wondering if you had an opinion on that. Thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Wow. Okay, well, yes, we've looked at the stellar scale. And the other thing is that why do you keep seeing the solar boat? You see Osiris, you see Isis behind him, and you see Osiris with his sword pointing. So if you look at the stellar scale, we've got the belt of Orion, which is Giza, and then we've got the Pleiades, which is Abusir, and Sirius is always behind. And so they call it the dog star because the dog is following behind a human, right? And if you look at the configuration along the Milky Way, which is the celestial Nile or the Nile, everywhere that configuration always follows along with it. In other words, I mean, when I looked at it in Starry Night, I'm like, yeah, that's fantastic. They understood. It's clear as day. And so, yes, Nibiru could be part of that. Hakim used to say that Nibiru was Abu Rosh. And it, you know, it can't, if Orion and the Pleiades are point, you know, it's up to speculation. Like, we haven't proven what's where, but it's definitely a sky-ground correlation.
Okay, next we go to our west of the Rockies, Margo in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Margo, go ahead.
This is an awesome show, George.
Oh she's God. Something, isn't she?
Yep. Wow. My question is, do you think that Lemuria and Atlantis and the fall of Egypt all have a correlation? Plus, do you think that the priesthood of the Druids in Stonehenge sold out for the same sort of reasons that you were talking about in Egypt, sold out to the Catholic priesthood? Do you think that that was the same sort of thing that was going on?
Thank you, Margot. Actually, I do. All of what you've just mentioned were different time frames, but I think that we go through cycles of enlightenment and cycles of corruption, and they are represented in these legends, yes.
Because I had a vision when I was probably about 15 years old, and somehow I was a priest in this kind of round table sort of thing, and we were discussing something that was very important, and it had to do with the future of our culture, and I was disagreeing with this very powerful priest. And this very powerful priest had everybody else on his side, and I decided, okay, that's fine. Whatever you decide, I'm going to leave. And I decided to go, and when I stepped outside of some decision had been made, and it was like it skipped in time, and some decision had been made, and I walked outside of this cave-like atmosphere or this temple sort of atmosphere and walked outside, and then there were all these balls of light, like they were, you know how there's spheres that have electricity and like little bolts of lightning and stuff, and it was like all these balls of light were being thrown around and people were screaming and stuff like that, and I met, and all of a sudden this other priest was in front of me and was throwing one of these at me. And I kind of caught it slow motion, threw it back, and destroyed him somehow, and realized that this was the end of an age. This was the end of an era, and nobody was going to understand for an awfully long time. And so I had to leave, and that was the end of the vision. And it was like I suddenly kind of correlated Egypt, and I saw the King Tut exhibit, and I stood at the mask for a long, 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 long time and felt like there was an awful lot of sorrow in that mask, and I saw the hieroglyphs inside, and none of the other artifacts really interest me except for standing in front of this mask. And the face on that, I realized that he'd been done a terrible injustice at the same time, and it was right around the same time I was having these visions. And so this is a fascinating show, and I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I just really thank you because you've answered a lot of questions. So I'll get off the line, but thank you so much.
Okay, you are quite welcome. Want to react to any of that, Carla?
Yeah, well, I'm just sitting here with a smile on my face, and the words that keep going through my head, Margo, is that you are one of us. There is some of us that just plain ordinary remember, and we were at these times, the crossroad times. And if you had all those feelings about Tut, you were probably there. There was a number of people who witnessed this sad situation. And it's the retelling of history isn't coming through accurately. And those of us that have cellular memory remember. Now, in terms of those balls of light, it sounds to me like they were being misused. But you'll see, we talk about orbs and ball lightning and that sort of thing in the Pyramid Code. So in the high-level technology episodes, you might find that interesting. Thank you, Marco.
Okay, next up we go to Syracuse, New York. It's Brad, east of the Rockies. Brad, you're up with us.
How you doing, George?
Hi, Brad. Good, Brad. Thanks.
Once again, great show. George, just real quick, your show has given me a new reason and a new level to start reading books again. And
perfect.
I was wondering if maybe somewhere on your website you could put like the Coast to Coast Library link to give a little synopsis of the books that you.
You know, that's not a bad idea. I'll get with Lex on that. We'll start working on something.
Sometimes you have people on, and I'm out in my garage because I'm not going to wake my wife up. But and then the old low tech pencil and paper. I never remember to bring that out here. But Carmen, my question to you is, and I heard you speaking of global warming. I've heard reports that the polar caps on Mars are also shrinking, which, to be honest with you, I don't think we have too much to do with that. And I didn't know if you heard that report, too. Maybe if you could give me a little insight on that, and I'll get off. Thank you so much.
Yes, Brad. I actually have heard that all planets are heating up, and it is not something that we necessarily have done. Now, I mean, there's so much speculation about what's really going on with that. And for sure, there's a syndrome that may be changing the temperature of the planet, but it's also a real climate change in that it's cold in some places. But yes, I've heard that all the planetary systems are heating up.
Okay, we go to Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Mike, you're up with us. Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, yes, great to talk to you. I'd like to thank you for all your hard work and all your time spent in Egypt. And the thing is, to me, it's still seems like Stone Age technology, and to say that they were more advanced than we are today is very disheartening to me. Compared to our engineering and our medical advances and our transportation advances, when I look at ancient Egypt, it just seems like Stone Age technology to me. And that's, you know, really all I've got. Have a good evening. Thank you.
Well, okay. We're not used to things made out of stone being high-level technology, and when you say our advances in transportation, I think teleportation is pretty advanced. It's the way we're looking at it, and I'm wondering if you're looking at the whole picture, because they had some pretty cool stuff that didn't last the 5,000 years and certainly hasn't come into our consciousness. So the jury's still out on that, Mike.
Carmen, if you could get one question answered about what you've been studying and researching over all these years, just one, what would it be?
Okay, the transmutation of the atom. How exactly did that work? Because the cities involved manifestation, alchemy, bilocation. I mean, science fiction is really science. I'd like to know a little bit more about how that worked. The Vedic texts describe it. But I'm convinced that the ancients were using it. So how did that work would be my question.
Good point. Next up we go to first-time caller, Lawrence in El Paso. Lawrence, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for having me. I'm a big fan of this show. It's
sure
awesome to be on here. Well, this lady is very intelligent, so my question won't be too intelligent, I guess. But I was wondering if anybody had actually dug underneath the pyramid, if they actually found the solid base at the bottom. Or, I mean, I have a theory that maybe, you know, it's double-sided. It's not just, from the bottom, from the sand up, but actually goes down deep. So I was, listening to how she was saying that there are other passages and tunnels down underneath certain areas. So I guess, I don't know if that's just my main question, sorry, but thank you so much.
Right. Well, thank you, Lawrence. You know what? There's a pit at the bottom of the Great Pyramid, and there has been some excavations that were requested to be done. Of course, it's flatly refused by the Department of Antiquities, and what they generally do is they collect people's proposals and say yes and lead them along, and then at the very end they say no, and 2 years later they come out with their own research about it. But this business about what's underneath and whether it's etheric or whether it's real, Whether they're ever going to report on it or what's down there is a big, big question. But I have to say that when we did our filming inside the pit, there are extra passageways in there that were not there years ago because I spent, you know, many, many hours in the pit by myself. And I'm pretty familiar with what was in there. I think what you're referring to is the inverted pyramid that's like the Merkaba. And what we have to understand, because the Egyptian work, it's not just the stone. And because we're talking about levels of consciousness, there is a lot that exists on the etheric plane. And that's what we're picking up on about it, even though you haven't been to Egypt, I'm guessing. So, yes, I think that energetically that is correct, Lawrence.
And when's your next trip to Egypt?
Actually, to tell you the truth, after all these years, since I'm a little girl, I'm not planning another trip, to tell you the truth.
Really?
Really. I mean, it doesn't mean I'm not going to end up there. Because I feel like it's in the can. We've got the footage. There's something resolved, mission accomplished. I'm not running back there. And you know what? It's difficult there. And I was wearing rose-colored glasses and, I suppose, being protected, but it's rough. You know, there's a lot of traffic. There's a lot of crazy stuff that goes on there. And
is it safe?
Well, I've had safe things happen and unsafe things happen. I'm not I'm not scared of terrorists or any of that. It's just more the wear and tear and the pollution and the craziness and the fact that I think I'm done.
All done.
Maybe. Yep.
Next up, we go to Asheville, North Carolina. Charlie, go ahead.
Hi. Fascinating program. I'm sorry I wasn't able to tune in a little bit earlier this evening, Dr. Walter. I did happen to hear you discussing the issue of the church combination of the idea of reincarnation.
Uh-huh.
And I think there may have been a bit of, if I may, since I've done some study on this myself, it wasn't really the Council of Nicaea that made any sort of condemnation of this. It was a later council that was called in large measure by the Byzantine Empress Theodora, if I recall correctly. I think it was in the 7th century, who called a church council to try to get Origen condemned for his teaching about reincarnation. Because apparently she'd been a notorious sinner herself and was afraid of the consequences of karma.
I want to talk about the reincarnation when we come right back, Carmen. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Dr. Carmen Bolter. Your phone calls as well. Of the five different programs of your special, your documentary, The Pyramid Code, I would assume each ingredient is necessary for the next one. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, it all fits together and weaves it, and they're all very distinct. It's not just a run-on, same old, same old. Yeah, and they're stepping stones that build the case, and you can't do it in a few minutes. It really takes a little while to develop the point.
All right, let's go to Craig in Cleveland, Ohio. There you go, Craig. Take it away.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
The best guest that I can recall you having on for a long time.
She's good.
Yeah, she's the best. I just bought all her DVDs for my family for Christmas presents.
Well, how about that? All right, good for you.
I just want to cover a couple notes. She seems to elaborate on Edgar Cayce's findings and taking it a little further. And my question is, I wish she would elaborate on the quartz floor. I'm on Travelocity right now, going to Egypt to look at the quartz floors.
You'd like to go and see the floors and know where they are?
Yes. I'm a rock man, and I do rocks. I give quartz to everybody I know to help them get through these times. So quartz is very important.
Okay, well, I'm going to direct you back to the Pyramid Code in episode 1 and 2, and you will see once you get in Egypt, like where Hakim is standing, where the blocks are, you pretty much can identify from the pictures where this quartz is. And I bet if you walk around, now some of the pieces are smaller than others, but at Abu Ghraib, this is a difficult place to get to because it's through a mango grove and almost nobody knows where it is. And there's a quartz crystal altar there and a bunch of instruments. If you want to email me, I can point you exactly where, in the direction of where they are, but you will see pretty specifically in those episodes where the quartz is.
Okay, very good. Next up, we go to San Francisco. We've got Max. Hey, Max, go ahead.
Thank you. Your knowledge is very impressive. And basically, you're talking about how dumbed down we are. We sure are in this era. So the question is, Andrew Thomas wrote a 1971 book, We Are Not the First, which says Einstein was taken to task when he mentioned that his relativity theories were really something he just rediscovered from antiquity. Uh-huh. Now, that's the first thing I want to ask about. And second, this concept of carbon-14 and how things are dated, can you actually, I'm sure you can, explain the dating process? Because, for example, like the Shroud of Turin keeps coming up with several different dates as well as the destruction of Thera in the in Greece. So, you know, I've read four or five different dates for that. So I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks very much.
Oh, thank you, Max. It's a very good question. Now, the problem with carbon-14 is it can get contaminated very easily with somebody's fingers, anybody touching it. And there was a scientist conference, actually, where I met Zachariah Sitchin, and they were talking about dating techniques. And they did an experiment where they took one carbon sample, and they sent it to 14 different labs, and they came up with 14 different dates. It is notoriously incorrect, and it's one of the ways. The other thing is that the older something is, the more inaccurate carbon-14 is. Now, there are some new dating techniques, but nothing is going to really date something to 50,000 BC, except perhaps archaeoastronomy. So if you go and really do some research on carbon-14, you're going to find that it fails miserably, and this Shroud of Turin is an example where you get a lot of different dates. So we are not the first. Nikola Tesla didn't invent, he remembered, or picked up on something that the ancients already knew. And so, yep, we're dumbed down, and we're not the smartest we've ever been, and this information is somewhere out there, and it's for us to connect back in. Thanks, Matt.
Okay, we go to Maywood, New Jersey. Steve, you're up with us. Hey, Stephen.
George, pleasure.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve, sure.
Hello, I have plans to build a pyramid myself.
How big?
I've been working on for about 8 years. I'm just trying to get the finances now, and I just wonder if you have any tips. I'm going to use a 52-degree pitch, and I'm building it for the purpose of showing it, to use it for clinics or hospitals to help people heal better.
Oh, okay. Well, make sure it's aligned. I know that they've built some pyramids in Edmonton as an agricultural exhibit, and they made sure they were not aligned because they were afraid of what would happen. I'm curious about the 52-degree pitch because you'll see that there are pyramids at 51.5 degrees, 53.5 degrees. If you look at Dashur and the Red Pyramid at Dashur, the Great Pyramid, and the Second Pyramid, I don't think any of them are going to come up at 52 degrees. So you can do some research to find out about that. And if it's about healing, you might want to examine how the pyramids are aligned by studying some of the books out there. So good luck with it. Sounds great.
So what do you think Zahi will say of your theories?
They're all nonsense, of course. Absolutely 100% nonsense is what he'll say.
He's protecting.
Whatever.
Yeah.
He is a perfect example of a patriarch who is insisting on control. You know, he may be a nice guy on the sidelines, but these are World Heritage sites, and they're not protecting what needs to be protected, but they're sure holding people back from making honest discoveries. And that's just not right. Nothing happens in Egypt without Zahi's permission. And even with Zahi's permission, the watchmen are, you know, no, you don't have the permission, you can't get in. What permission is a bill that you pay them for still getting hassled and not being allowed to do what you're going to do. I could do a whole show on just that.
So, are they petrified of him?
No. Well, I mean, he's listening, so most people have an opinion. But he's not considering what the people in the village around the pyramids need. Nothing is about helping humanity or helping people. It's all about power and control and money. And that's not right with something as precious as this information.
Is that why he's so rigid about every theory out there, unless it's Egyptian?
Yeah, the answer is no. I mean, there's people who say no to everything. I'm right, you're wrong, the end. But there's got to be something in the middle, and there's got to be discussion. Or let me hear what you have to say. You know what I'm saying? There's no, you have ears blocked, eyes closed. No. It's a pretty locked shut case.
All right. Let's go next to Michael driving around in his truck in Kentucky. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, George. Hi, Carmen. How are you, Bo?
Good.
You had mentioned earlier in the program about anomalies in your photographs inside the pyramids. Could you elaborate on that? I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Michael. Actually, these apparitions look more like smoke, and they were pink and green with white edges. But what's happening, I've taken lots of groups over to Egypt, and over the years with higher resolution cameras, more and more orbs are being seen. And there's people who have studied orbs, and they actually, if you blow them up on these high resolution cameras, there's geometric shapes in there. I've got John Burke and Claude Swanson talking about these electrified bits of air. Now, people who have studied them will say that the orbs are ancestors, energy beings that like animals. They like sacred sites. They show up more at dawn and dusk. And it's energy. There's something to it. And when there's a really high vibrational frequency, there are more orbs. And that's another way of knowing that as we go through this transition, we're getting more in touch with this kind of energy because there's more orbs in the pictures. I mean, sometimes it looks like a blizzard. There's so many orbs. And they're very well featured in Episode 2 of the Pyramid Code. So they're real. And you can poo-poo them and say that it's dust on the camera. There's much more to it than that. Thanks, Michael.
What do you think happened to this wireless power system that they might have had?
Oh, well, Tesla was driven into obscurity because nobody could make a profit.
Right.
All of this
is about a
monopoly of people making money at our expense. And so we're all paying through the nose and being controlled. Like, if you don't want to be on the grid and you want to use wind power, you got to pay a levy because they've got us and they want us paying our money to them. It's completely unnecessary. We have access to this technology now, and we always have. And Hakim will say it takes a beam of the sun on water moving through a zigzag pattern, and there's tons of research that's been done. But that's the other thing, is the different disciplines don't speak to one another. It's all about money.
Always
and someone's even said, we wouldn't need money if we didn't have utilities. We could just barter everything. It's really, really, really an incredible thing. And in other countries where people can't afford it as much, I was saying this when we went into break, they just don't charge as much. Imagine running an air conditioner 24/7 in 50-degree, that's Celsius weather, for $9 a month. I mean, we are just paying too much. And and when you think it's not necessary, that's really threatening the power system.
And here we have old people dying, freezing or just getting too much heat because they can't afford their electric bills.
No, there's really
doesn't make
wrong.
Any sense.
There's really
let's go to
wrong.
We'll go next to Ontario, Canada. Hey, Luke, go ahead.
Hey there, how are you tonight, guys?
Good, Luke.
Great. Just had a couple of quick things, real fast. I've been listening for quite some time. I'm Nighthawk myself, actually, not the zone, but myself. Always up at nighttime. But anyway, quickly about the pyramids. It's kind of pyramids, Mayan, Egyptian, possibly a little bit of Atlantis in there. I can talk really fast, so I hope you're catching it all.
Yep.
But anyway, I was going to suggest that possibly when the 2012, the 26,000 years, there's the positive, the negative sort of cycles. The water level changed, so possibly everything was lower. They built some caves because they knew from the first cycle that it was going to flood again. They're all underground. That's why reptilians have, you know, they're underground sort of creators anyways. Grays have big eyes because they need to be able to see in the dark, the Illuminati. They could be basically under the pyramids, all these caverns that are partly man-made, partly natural, going down and down and down. We've heard many times about underground cities and caverns and stuff like that. So they could, you know, aliens, they don't have to come from another planet. They could be just the advanced technology that seems to be missing, quote unquote. Think of all the minerals and ores and all that kind of stuff they could be using literally from their own home environment under the ground in the cities and stuff like that. They could be using UFOs to fly around, but they don't have to come from other solar systems. They could be just coming out of our oceans. We talk about underwater UFOs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it could all be very possible. The only thing I do want to get in real quick, too, and I'll just get out of here right after that, it's 2012. I think there's going to be a big change no matter what happens. Whether something happens or nothing happens, I think people are on the edge so much about 2012. It's like, you know, a comet flies by, the Moonies kill themselves. We're all just so stressed. And I think since all the prophecies, Mayans, Christians, Egyptians, everybody seems to be pointing to 2012, everybody's going to be on a breaking point. And I think whether we wake up the next day and everything's fine or it stays, you know, or something catastrophic does happen, I think there's going to be a change, like everybody's saying, the enlightening. Possibly that's when they come back out. You know, maybe these early aliens and stuff that have been coming out could literally be like scouts coming out to see if we're ready, you know, checking the nuclear bases. Okay, we got to shut this stuff down so don't screw it up again. All this kind of stuff. They could be scouts. And I'll go. Have a great night. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, Luke. That was really a lot of stuff that you just ran through there. I don't think the reptilians are in the underground passageways of the pyramids because I think that was more of a machine again, you know, like I said about the oven. But there are underground cities, and yes, I've heard a lot of that about the big eyes and all of that. I don't think we're going to wake up on 2012, December 21st, and have anything particularly happen, because if you look at the Starry Night Pro stuff, our sun has been almost aligned December 21st at sunset, winter equinox, or sorry, winter solstice, 2008, 9, 10, 12, has been coming in a little bit more, and so we've been touching on this energy, and so when it happens on 2012, it strengthens the energy, and it's not something that is like monumental that's going to happen on one day. But I think the energy is building and it is increasing. And I'll leave it at that.
Next up, we go to Mesa, Arizona. Edward, you're on with Dr. Bolter. Go ahead, Edward.
Yeah, Dr. Bolton. This is Edward in Mesa, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a question for you. Did you ever check into the Valley of the Fallen or Segovia in Spain, where the cross has 899 steps to the foot of the cross, and if you go in underground, you see Jesus in...
Okay, I don't know if she ever went there. Did you?
I've been to Segovia, but not to the cross with 899 steps.
What would the significance of that be? Do you know? I don't.
No, I can't pick up on it.
Okay, Edward, thanks. Time for a couple more calls, and then we are out of time. Pittsburgh, we go in California. Hey, Carter, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Carter.
Yeah, how's it going there?
Good.
Yes, I was wondering, what's the difference between the Mayans pyramid and the Egyptians?
Well, you know, there's a lot of associations between the Mayans and the Egyptians, and there's some Mayan pyramids that were built a long time ago, the oldest ones that register a lot of orbs and a lot of activity in terms of the pyramids being charged. It's the more recently built ones that don't have that kind of charge. So they were the ones that were built out of ego in a later time, which is, again, an indication that older was probably purer. And we talk about the Mayan calendar and the Mayans, and they in the pyramid code, and they understood the importance of the galactic center and the pole and the whole way that the galaxy worked. And so it's just totally fascinating that more than one culture was very cognizant about our place in the universe.
And with those cultures, Carmen, again, lost information. It doesn't get carried on to us.
And the more recent copycat versions of what they were doing don't work. Like, they're not charged.
They don't work. They don't work at all.
Right.
Panama City, Florida, we go. Alex, we'll squeeze you in there. Go ahead.
Thanks. Dr. Bolter, I had a question about the missing capstone from the Great Pyramid. You know, I was reading Chariots of the Gods by Eric Van Daniken, and, you know, I'm really into that.
By the way, he's our guest last hour, Wednesday night.
Really?
Yes.
I'll be up for that.
He's out in Switzerland.
Anyway, getting back to that, is it possible that, you know, because you're saying that, they had a huge power source underneath the pyramid, that they actually used that, the capstone, as like a spacecraft, and, you know, it could use the power source to launch that, you know, into space for interplanetary interstellar travel, or that they might have used it as a weapon system and could have possibly used that to nuke Atlantis. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, I might not be wrong.
I really don't think that it was a weapon system unless it was taken over by another group, and that's not the root of who the Egyptians, the real Egyptians that built this stuff, were about. That, definitely no. After the capstone was taken off, I have heard that it would have been a landing spot to charge up craft. Again, I don't really think there's enough room up there, and it's also not completely flat the way, because I've been up there a couple of times. So I'm going to say no to that, though I have heard those theories.
Absolutely. Well, Carmen, get out your website, please, and how do people get the pyramid code?
Okay, it's pyramidcode.com, and you can order the pyramid code from Amazon.com, Barnes and Noble's.com, Culture International, and there's an 800 number, 24/7, 1-800-573-3782.
Great. Thanks, Carmen. Very informative night with you.